welcome to the Sweet Podcast with me, Mitchell Willis, and him, Michael Hall.
Good evening.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Yeah, we've got a different perspective this week. We're looking out the back window of your residence onto some beautiful gardens, some garages, and it's not as good as the front view, but you still get a very nice autumnal view wherever you look from your humble abode.
Absolutely. How's your weekend been?
It's been full of football.
It has.
Friday night I watched a little bit of the Sheffield United Sheffield Wednesday game, which we'll obviously come on to later in the Championship roundup. That was crap. Saturday I watched 90 minutes of dross from St Mary's, which we'll look forward to discussing in the second half. And on Sunday, you and I, with a couple of our pals and my parents, went to Nevermore, didn't we?
Not as chaperones, though.
No. We are old enough to go on our own to football. we had a great time at Guiseley, and I think most of you will be aware of the result there. It was brilliant. It almost made up for what happened on Saturday. What about you?
Yeah, very similar, really. Just a lot of football watching. And looking forward to this as well. We've got a bumper edition with the Manchester Derby, of course. Two Merseyside teams faring differently, having a big impact as well. Some more movement at the bottom of the league along with this. We've obviously got the FA Cup round up and then also the Europa League as well.
The big reveal.
Absolutely. I'll be reporting back from that a little bit later on. But should we get into it now?
Let's do it. Let's go to the Etihad, where a convincing home victory saw Pep Guardiola's Manchester City beat Manchester United 3-1.
Absolutely. There's a huge amount of anticipation for this one, as there always is for the derby. But I think with Manchester United finding some form, buoyed by a win at Juventus, which was fantastic, it was a bit of a shocker as well. I think they would have fancied their chances to pick something up in this one. However, when you've got a purring Manchester City in your way, you are well and truly up against it.
And they didn't give Manchester United any time to settle, did they? They came flying out of the traps, they had so much of the ball and basically just took advantage of the fact that they were able to pass the ball around nicely. There was a stat kicking around that I think it was within the first 5 minutes City put together something like 95 passes and Manchester United put together 5, and that just set the tempo for the whole game.
Yeah, it did. You know, they had, as you say, a lot of the ball, and you know, they took advantage with a goal in, I think it was 10 minutes, was it? 10, 11 minutes from David Silva, and you know, from there you kind of wondered how this was going to go for Manchester United. You thought actually this could be an absolute drubbing, and I think Manchester City were almost a little bit too comfortable at times in the first half, and although they did create a few chances, they didn't necessarily look to punish them. And it wasn't until the second half where you kind of hope for a bit of a fight back from Manchester United, as you've seen in recent weeks. But it was City that then extended the lead and really changed the course of the game from there.
And I think the thing with City is they just dictate everything. They dictated the tempo. They dictated when they wanted to attack, when they wanted to defend. When Manchester United had the ball, they didn't panic. They pressed when they wanted to. And they just seem to get everything right. And I don't condone what Mourinho said, because I think it's a really disrespectful comment to say that they'd had two friendly games against Shakhtar and Southampton. You can only beat the opposition that you're up against. And ultimately, Pep Guardiola and the Manchester City side don't pick who they're going to play in the Champions League and at what point. Manchester United went to Juventus. They obviously got a really, really good result there. But you've still got to prepare in the same way that you would have done if you'd have played Southampton or Shakhtar Donetsk. And I think he was looking for excuses from the start, pretty much. I think he was well aware that Manchester United were probably unlikely to ever go and properly trouble City. I know that obviously when Lukaku came on, made it 2-1, it wasn't really tight at any point, was it?
But then, I mean, you look back at last season, it was very similar. You know, the Manchester United did grab the goal, and from there, you know, they went on and performing almost a miracle, and in this one they didn't really seem to get going at all. When they went 2-1, you thought, right, here we go, they're going to come back into this now and at least put up a bit of a fight for it. But we obviously saw in the third goal that, you know, 40 odd passes from Manchester City, part and parcel of that is the fact that they weren't closed down enough and there wasn't enough pressure on them. And at 2-1 down, you've still got the opportunity to get back into the game. And as much as you want to sit back and try and get the ball just from a mistake, Manchester City will not make a mistake if they've just got the ball at their feet.
I think the only way that they're making mistakes at the moment is via their goalkeeper, who for the first year in the Premier League looked pretty much untouchable. Yep. His his distribution's second to none in the Premier League, and shot stopping's up there as well. But the maybe it's a lapse of concentration. It's difficult to say. But the last two games at home in the league, he's given away almost identical penalty kicks, one against Southampton and one against Manchester United on Sunday. And his judgment, is it his judgment? Is it concentration? What do you think it comes down to?
I would imagine a lot of it is concentration, to be honest. Manchester City, although they haven't scored as many goals this season as they did last, they have definitely conceded less. They're conceding less chances. They tend to play a lot higher up the pitch as well than most teams. So naturally, Edison's probably got 30 yards between him and the defender for 80 minutes of the game, probably. So I'd imagine it is difficult to keep your focus because there's only so much they can pass back to him. There's only so many chances is going to be that will be created in and around the box. So ultimately, how would you regain your concentration every single time? And you know, it's probably no surprise that the two penalties came from his mistakes over the last 2 weeks. And I think ultimately Manchester City do have enough quality to kind of bail him out every week anyway. So if that was the case, he could probably concede a penalty in every game. And I think when you look at it at the end of the season, it probably wouldn't make a huge amount of difference.
Yeah, I think that's the argument at the moment is that it doesn't really make any difference to the results. The bearing is very little in terms of the overall outcome. And I think as a Manchester City fan, it obviously you never want to see it happen, but maybe it makes the games a little bit more exciting to watch from a neutral perspective, possibly. But I look at Manchester City and I look at Manchester United, and I don't think the gulf has ever been so big. You look at the style of football, Manchester United like to be very direct, they like to go long, and as soon as Lukaku came on, they almost gained momentum but lost any ability to play football the right way. And Manchester City are obviously the complete opposite. You look at the points differential between the two teams, it's 12 points difference after 12 games. Now, I get it's unlikely to continue like that for the rest of the season, but if it did, that'd be nearly a 40-point gap between the two teams. And it's just mind-boggling to think how poles apart they are.
And what's worse with that is that Manchester United will quite possibly still qualify for a European competition. They could be 40 points behind and still qualify for a competition, which is absolute madness, really. But, I mean, you only have to look at them at the moment, and they have a minus one goal difference, which is just so poor for a team of their quality. And ultimately, the amount of money that they've spent and the team that they've assembled, they should be at least able to outscore the opposition over a season.
You're right. I want to talk about somebody who we don't often talk about because I thought he was fantastic in this game. Fernandinho has been at Manchester City now for years, and there's always talk of them bringing in somebody else who's going to come in and replace him, a defensive midfielder who can score goals. They were linked with Naby Keita, who can do a similar job but plays a little bit further forward. And every single season he retains his place in the side. He's like a metronome. He just keeps it ticking over. His tackling at times can be poor, but I think he got it spot on Sunday. I just think that Guardiola has got somebody in Fernandinho that he can just trust to go out there every week. And he's got Gundogan, who's obviously coming back from injury, but will probably struggle to get back into the City side if they continue to play the way that they have been of late.
Yeah, I'd say he's probably the most underrated player in the league for me, really. He's able to dictate the tempo of games as well. I think people don't give him enough credit for the fact that he can get the ball forward better than anyone, or as good as anyone else as well. And I think in that team, you know, it's difficult to stand out for someone who's got attacking prowess as well. But obviously he's picks up the odd goal here and there, the odd assist as well. But I think more importantly, he, as we say, just keeps it ticking over. And as a result of that, they're able to go forward and play forward. But equally, you see him make an interception on the halfway line, he's happy to go back to the goalkeeper and start again. And that's obviously crucial to have that kind of security, that safety net over you, and someone who's willing to just stop and start again. And then you've got someone like Raheem Sterling, who has come in for a little bit of criticism.
Yeah, I don't really think that either of the things that he's been criticised for this week are really fair. The penalty against Shakhtar wasn't a penalty, but people who are saying that he should have gone over to the ref and told them that it wasn't a penalty and that he basically received no contact. First of all, I'm not convinced that Sterling even knew that there wasn't contact. I think he went down, he tripped over, and I don't really think he was fully aware where that contact had come from. You look at it the other end of the pitch, if somebody brings down a player and he's the last man and the referee doesn't see it, does he run up to the ref and say that should have been a penalty? It works both ways, and I don't think that Sterling should be criticised. I also wonder why Guardiola went over and spoke to him about showboating at the end of this game, because it kind of reminded me of what happened with Nathan Redmond last season, and Guardiola went and sort of publicly dressed him down on the pitch, didn't he? And
yeah.
And it's just a really weird one. I get that Guardiola is probably the the biggest perfectionist in world football, but you should be able to celebrate in victory as well. And I think it maybe sent the wrong message out on Sunday.
Potentially. Well, let's move on from them to their rivals, Liverpool, who had a 2-0 win against Fulham. And it's fair to say that many would have expected an absolute rout here for them, really. But it's possibly slightly underwhelming. There's a few controversial seconds in this one where Mitrovic had one disallowed for Fulham, which, you know, it's harsh, but ultimately right. Then Salah's goal moments later possibly came from a moving ball at a goal kick. Again, you know, it's minimal. It arguably evens itself out, though. Liverpool have had one at Arsenal last week that was wrongly chalked off, and, you know, you could have an argument that's a bigger effect on the game. So I think ultimately there's nothing to really moan about. You know, if Fulham score a goal, no disrespect to them, they possibly still would have lost anyway.
I think the issue with scoring at Anfield is that straight away you sit 10 yards further back, and yep. you invite Liverpool onto you. And I know that Liverpool need space to play the type of football that Klopp wants them to, but they're so adaptable. They're unique in the style that they possess at home, really. They can go direct when they need to. They can press the ball. They're quite happy to keep possession. It basically just depends who they're playing. And I think that manner of football that Klopp's developed under them will always see them do better than the majority of the teams that go there.
That said, though, it doesn't quite click for Liverpool like it does for say Manchester City. It's an easy enough comparison. You know, they generally have a lot of the ball, and they've got a clinical front three as well, as clinical as Manchester City on their day, but they're not quite blowing away teams like possibly they were last year, and obviously like Manchester City are. And is there a reason for that?
Well, I think it's a combination. I think you look at the goals that Firmino was scoring last season, and he's on a pretty barren patch so far. I think Klopp won't take him out of the side because he knows how well he interchanges with the other two. And I think that also the pressure is now on the three of them rather than just on Salah. I think that last season Salah was pretty much scoring every game, and as a result people were focusing on him. I think now he's not had a terrible start to the season, but obviously he's not been able to replicate what he did last year, and that will be one of the reasons that naturally they're not scoring as many goals, because confidence isn't as high as it potentially was at times last year. But at the end of the day, the league title won't come down to goal difference. And if Liverpool win week in, week out and continue to push City in the way that they are at the moment, then Klopp won't care if they're winning 1-0 or 6-0. It's great to win games 6-0, and I'm sure Manchester City fans absolutely love every second of it. But the most important thing from a Liverpool point of view is clean sheets. They are so much better defensively. They've got so many better defensive-minded tacticians in that side now, and they know when to play a ball back. They don't always look for the forward pass, and they've just got composure, which I think they lacked so much last season. I think that's the one thing to take away from this game. I agree with your earlier point. I think most people expected Liverpool to probably score 4 or 5 against Fulham. It doesn't matter. If you win in those games,
you're right.
Look at what happened to them midweek as well. It was important that they bounced back. It was a really poor result over in Belgrade, and a result that I don't think anyone saw coming. So the fact that they were able to get back on track will please Klopp. What Liverpool don't want to do is get on a run of dropping points. If they're able to stay within those top two positions in the Champions League group and go unbeaten in the Premier League for a little bit longer, then the confidence that should help the team with should set them in good stead for the second half of the season.
Well, that's it. They're 12 unbeaten, whereas this stage last season they were 8 points worse off as well. So there's huge improvements that have been done at Liverpool, and you know, we shall see at the end of the season how that's paid off. But Fulham probably unlucky not to get some joy here. A few good chances, didn't quite get the rubber the green, but a big international break ahead. Will it just click for them eventually? I think we spoke about this over the weekend together, didn't we?
We did, and I'm still of the opinion that they're not going to finish in the bottom three.
Yep.
I kind of have to cling to it because I've said it so many times now, but at some stage something will go right for that team, and you would imagine that the international break is a perfect opportunity. The issue that they've got is by bringing all the players that they did in over the summer, most of them are internationals, so naturally they will be going away this week, and therefore does Jukanovic work with the players that he's got in positions that they might not play in the next league game, or does he just work tactically with the players that he knows are going to slot back in? It's such a difficult one, because as a Fulham fan, you had such high expectations this season. You really wanted your team to do well, and they're flattered to deceive so far. They've got a huge game after the international break, and we'll be there. It's Fulham, yep. Southampton, and I would argue that if they don't get their season off to a real start by beating Southampton, then Jukanovic could probably be sacked. And it's a massive shame, because he's done so much hard work in getting two teams promoted to the Premier League. And then if he only lasts a few months of that time, then it kind of sends really, really poor manager messages out, if you like, for those who are trying to get promoted. But it's a catch-22.
It is indeed. And we'll move on to their neighbours, Chelsea, who are also challengers for the title, of course. And they drew 0-0 with Everton. Sarri, the first manager to go his first 12 games unbeaten in the Premier League. And Chelsea had chances in this one. They just couldn't make it count. Sarri said the team haven't approached the last two or three games in the right manner. A disappointing result in the Europa League. They didn't look great last weekend despite the win. And, you know, I think for them, they need to just keep going. They need to keep ticking over, because I don't think they've got the same amount of quality as Liverpool and Manchester City. So for them, it's all about remaining unbeaten, keeping some level of consistency, and trying to get, you know, the likes of Hazard, Morata into the games as much as possible, get them firing. And hopefully for them, for their sake, they can kind of get through a difficult period and still be up there challenging.
I think the most important thing from a Chelsea point of view is that they don't lose ground on the top two. Every week that they go into their fixture, no, if they know that by winning they could go top even for a couple of hours, or if they're able to go level with Manchester City or Liverpool, then I think that will breed more confidence within that team. We know that they've not been brilliant all season. They've probably had five or six games where they've been streaks ahead of their opponent, but actually if you look at the majority of games that they've played, they have been small margins in terms of the victories that they've achieved. So they I don't think they're a million miles away, but like I said a couple of weeks ago, and I think it's a point that you've raised a couple of times, I'm still not convinced that they will go all the way with the top two sides. I still fully believe that Manchester City will win the league, and I think that Liverpool will probably have too much for Chelsea in finishing second as well.
Yeah, I agree. I think we have to talk about Jorginho's tackle on Sigurdsson. Thoughts?
It's a red card for me. I struggle to understand how it's not been given. I understand that the referee's angle is not great, but that's where you need help from wherever you are. I mean, the tackle doesn't take place too far away from where the fourth official stood, and I think that's where you need to give referees help. And actually, if the fourth official is going to be a fourth official, then have them stood there the whole game. Don't have them stood back in between the two dugouts, because then you're losing a pair of eyes that you are able to rely on within the rules at the moment.
I'd say my only slight defence is that because they were going at it for so long before, it may have been that it looked almost as if they were pulling each other into each other, and they pulled each other over. But, you know, there is no excuse. It's a terrible tackle, and it's one that could have caused much more of an injury to Sigurdsson than he kind of ended up with throughout the game.
Yeah, I'm not convinced he should have grabbed his head, though. I mean, that may have given the wrong impression to the referee, but yeah, it was a poor tackle, and you're right, it could have changed the game. I think that you look at another decision, this time in the Everton area, and your favourite player that they signed in the summer, Yerry Mina.
Yes.
Didn't exactly cover himself in glory, did he? I think it was a challenge on Morata.
No, well, I mean, you know, we have to get onto the flops of the season of Richarlison and Mina, obviously. And yeah, Mina came in for his first start to replace Kurt Zouma, who was ineligible against Chelsea. And he kept a clean sheet, so you can't take that away from him. But probably should have conceded a penalty as well. Conceded a number of chances, and he's been given the runaround by Morata too. So we'll see whether he keeps his place next week when Zouma's back. But yeah, that penalty decision that wasn't given, I would say, is a penalty any other day of the week.
I'm sure Jordan Pickford would have saved it anyway, and he had another good game, didn't he? He's really come on as a goalkeeper. He seems to be making less mistakes, and having a decent back four in front of you will naturally help that. I think that Everton are really starting to bring the players that they signed in the summer into the side now, and to be able to go to Chelsea, to be able to keep a clean sheet, will do massive amounts for that side, because defensively they've looked so frail over the last few seasons, and if they're able to build on that with the goals that they've had so far, then they should be looking 7th place, 8th, that sort of area. And we need to mention Richarlison. I know that you've just touched on him very very sharply there.
No goal.
Son's goals this week, indeed. And I think that makes it 2-2 in the charity bet. So we'll give a proper update on that after the international break, because I think that'll be sort of the first month.
Yeah, it's going to be really cold then as well. It's cold this weekend, just saying.
Long way to go to Brazil as well while the international break's on. Those air miles can do absolutely all sorts for player confidence.
They can indeed. Let's move to Crystal Palace, who went down 1-0 to Spurs, and it looked grim at Sellers Park on Saturday night. The game looked to suffer as a result, and almost the villain of last week was the hero in this one. Juan Foyth grabbed the only goal of the game, and Pochettino speaks very highly of him, and you'd think he's there to replace the centre-halves they have ahead of him if they get snapped up. He's had a tough start in this one. He's low on confidence, clearly, but as well as showing he still has a lot to learn, he grew into the game and obviously built his confidence up and got the winner as well.
Yeah, and Tottenham had so much more of the ball in this game. At Crystal Palace, it was almost like watching a training exercise at times, wasn't it? And they were unspectacular, but they probably were able to show a side of the game that they've struggled with over the past 4 or 5 years. They were able to win a game where they didn't play very well. They had a game midweek, which obviously took a lot out of them. 2 late goals against PSV, and that's kept their Champions League hopes alive. And if you'd have offered Pochettino a narrow win over both of these sides this week, he would have absolutely taken it. He doesn't strike me as the type of person who's looking for the perfect performance, a la Guardiola. He's more concerned with the result, and Tottenham showed real steel in this, and they score goals from all areas, and it's taken pressure off Harry Kane this season, because we all know he's struggling, but I think they've got the best away record in the Premier League so far this season.
Yeah, 3 more away wins in 2018 than any other side, and 12 wins away is huge, and I think that's testament to the fact they are just willing to go and win the game, and almost at all costs, and they're not overly fussed about the way they'll win it. I'm sure they've scrapped their way to a few of those wins, but why is that? What is it? Is it just the mentality, or is it the way they play? Are they set up to defend away from home and play on the break?
I think playing on the break suits Tottenham. I know that they've had to rely, certainly this season, on different personnel. They haven't had your... I think last season, a lot of the time, they would go out, they would have Dele Alli, Christian Eriksen, Harry Kane, and then Son would come in off the bench. But personnel-wise, it's been different so far this season. So maybe it's the fact that players have gone in there and had more to prove, that they've been given a chance, and therefore they've upped their game. It's not easy to put your finger on, but it will be so pleasing for Pochettino, given the amount of turbulence that's going on off the pitch with the continued delay of the stadium, the lack of signings in the summer. There's talks that nobody's going to be brought in January either. So I think Tottenham are doing all they can really at the moment, and the Premier League title is probably a step too far this season. But for them, if they can finish in the top four, that will feel like they've won the league, because there's so much that's gone on. People have written them off so many times, and players there who've had such good seasons in the past just aren't stepping up. So it's a transition, and I think that every win they get is a step towards the end goal, which is Champions League football in a new stadium next season.
And what do Crystal Palace do? Do they just wait to change things up in January, or is it too late then? You know, they work hard, they look relatively solid, but you can't continue to not win at home, not score goals, and really not look like they're going to cause teams too much trouble.
I think their forwards really lack confidence. We've spoken until the cows come home about the Wilfried Zaha effect. When he misses a game, not only do they not win, they never pick any points up. And psychologically, that must be so damaging to those players. They'll want to get the monkey off their back. And the difficulty that you've got in this situation is you're almost in a no-win. You push forward, you pour everyone forward in search of a result, and a team like Tottenham are just going to pick you off. So naturally, you try and stay in the game. Conditions were horrendous there on Saturday night as well, which wouldn't have suited them. But somebody needs to step up for Palace. They don't necessarily have the most goal-hungry strikers at the club. I think that we all know the exploits of players like Benteke. Connor Wickham's coming back to full fitness, but is he going to come in and score the goals they need? I think that what they have to do is back Roy Hodgson in January and probably spend 20-25 million on a striker who is going to get them 10 goals between then and the end of the season.
Absolutely. Well, let's move on to Spurs North London rivals Arsenal, who drew 1-1 with Wolves, and Arsenal once again with a poor start, and rightly so. They were punished by Wolves.
They were indeed, yeah. And only Arsenal and, wait for it, Cardiff. They're the only teams not to be leading at half-time this season, which, when you think Arsenal have won at least 13 or 14 games, it's a bonkers stat. I don't know why they're not able to start. I know that they obviously had the Europa League game that you were at on Thursday night, but not many of those players who played in that played against Wolves on Sunday. Wolves were able to open them up defensively, and the goal that Cavallero scored will be incredibly frustrating for Emery.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Arsenal were looking to move the ball forward as they do, started both Lacazette and Aubameyang, but I think actually possibly see why the two of those don't start together more often. You know, Wolves were so organised and just played on the counter-attack, and it was a fantastic tactic and approach to the game, and, you know, really there should have been more than one up at half-time, and I think, as you say, it will be so frustrating because it looks really obvious to highlight what the issues are with them, and I think obviously there's something psychologically that isn't quite right for them, that they can't get off to a good start and they almost need to go behind or at least be struggling to get back into the game. And you know, the second half was like that. It was all Arsenal, still much of the ball and plenty of chances, but just not their day, and you know, they can't afford to not be having their day on a very regular basis if they are going to concede. And you know, the equaliser came from a cross, which probably says it all. It was a great ball in either way, into the corridor of uncertainty. But they could have lost it. They could have easily lost it. Two massive chances late on for Wolves on the break. Leno came to the rescue, made some cracking saves. And then, nearly the last kick of the game, Morgan Gibbs-White again, who came on last week and was fantastic. He's come in and hit the frame of the goal with a wonderful effort. And I think Emery will look at that and think, actually, we've done very well to get a point there. And is that the right thing to be thinking after a home game against Wolves?
I think that in any game where you're losing at home, you probably will take a point. If it gets to that stage against a side who are probably going to finish in the top eight in the Premier League this season, I don't necessarily think it's a terrible result for Arsenal. If they'd have lost that game at home, then it undoes all the good work that has been done so far this season. They've made the Emirates into a little bit of a fortress. I think the only team that's gone there and won this season is Manchester City. And they basically want to keep this run going. We've talked a lot about Liverpool and Chelsea and Manchester City and how they've gone unbeaten. And Arsenal, you can almost put them in that bracket because they've done so well in recent weeks. And the frustrating thing from an Arsenal point of view is you have to win these games if you want to keep pace with the top four teams. And the realistic point of view is that across the season, teams will drop points against Wolverhampton Wanderers. They are a decent attacking team, and it's probably harder to play them on your home pitch where you're expected to win, because they'll be able to set up in a way where, especially with Adama Traore, and I think it was him that created the chance for Gibbs-White towards the end, they can set a trap, and as they soak the pressure up from you knocking it around their 18-yard box, naturally they can spring it, and that's a tactic that teams who are in the top four and top six and are established will have to learn to deal with.
That is all for part one. Join us after this short break where we will take our trip to the Championship.
Listen to how excited he is.
Should have gone to Specsavers, Charlie, because I'll tell you what, he's not offside. Well, he's absolutely bang in line, not offside.
Well, maybe you should go also then, Jeff, because you couldn't see driving home the other night because you don't even wear your glasses in TV in case you get slagged off. So you just stick to Specsavers and I'll do the game.
Welcome back to part two, and we are taking that trip to the Championship. And what a weekend we had in the Championship, with a weekend that started with a Steel City derby that really failed to deliver with a 0-0 on Friday night. However, Saturday well and truly exploded. One of the results of the day was Villa winning away at Derby with a 3-0 victory. Goals from John McGinn, Tammy Abraham.
John who?
John McGinniester, sorry.
Thank you.
Tammy Abraham, and another belting free kick from Conor Hourihan saw the revival under Dean Smith continue. And Villa, arguably the better side throughout. They've moved up to 11th, sit just 4 points from the playoffs with a home game next to look forward to against Birmingham City in the second City derby. And they also leapfrogged Birmingham on goal difference as well. And this was down to Birmingham failing to take advantage of a 2-0 half-time lead against Hull at St Andrews. Hull actually went 3-2 up in this one, but Shea Adams completed his hat-trick late on to rescue a point. And at the top of the league, Norwich continued their impressive form with a 4-3 win over Millwall at Carrow Road. They went into injury time 3-2 down as well, ended up scoring two goals in seven injury time minutes to take 3 points. And then another side that scored four goals were West Brom, who emphatically trounced Leeds United at the Hawthorns. It was 4-1, and the only one for Leeds was an injury time consolation. And said last week about West Brom, they seem to have one really good game, one really bad game, and you know they don't get much better than a 4-1 win against Leeds. And then you've also got wins in the top half for Swansea and QPR and Middlesbrough, who after three successive draws beat Wigan 2-0 to move into second place. And then Ipswich Town, Paul Lambert's Ipswich Town, remain rock bottom despite their second draw under him. They're 5 points adrift on 11 points behind four teams on 16 points. They really need to get cracking if they want to survive and ensure they don't regret getting rid of big old Mick McCarthy after last season.
And that was kind of where the Football League finished for this weekend, wasn't it? Because as we mentioned earlier, it was FA Cup first round proper weekend. And as we said at the start of the show, we had a fantastic day over at Guiseley. And we started our road to the FA Cup feature. And I mean, Guiseley, what an absolutely beautiful place. It's for those of you that don't know, it's a small suburb on the outskirts of Leeds. So I think it was about 25 minutes in the car for us on Sunday. And they took on League Two Cambridge United. And what a game it was. 4-3. However, that definitely doesn't tell the full story. Guiseley took the lead from arguably one of the goals of the round from Will Hatfield. And then Cliff Moyo doubled the lead from a looping cross that he will be claiming was a shot. but I think you probably have to blame David Ford for this. Ex-international goalkeeper David Ford.
Big David Ford.
He's put a few pounds on of late, hasn't he? And it was 4-0 to Guiseley after 65 minutes. And you kind of just wondered how many they were going to be able to rack up against their Football League opponents. But then the worry started to creep in. What looked like a consolation goal, I guess, you'd imagine, after 65 minutes. I think we all thought that Guiseley would just close the game out. But then Cambridge got it back to 4-3. And I think there was 1.5 minutes of stoppage time left. And it was so nervy, wasn't it? I mean, the people around us were so worried about the potential of letting a 4-goal lead slip. But the Lions of Guiseley held on to record a famous victory. And they started off in the second qualifying round, Guiseley, didn't they?
Yeah. 4-0 away win at Staveley Miners Welfare. And then they were taken to a replay to beat Cleethorpes Town before qualifying for the first round with a 3-1 win at Stourbridge before they took on Cambridge United, sealing that place in the second round proper for the second time in their history.
And I think that we need to talk a little bit about Guiseley, the ground, the atmosphere, and pies and beers were consumed as well, weren't they?
Yeah, it was lovely. I had a lovely old time myself.
Can I get your pie rating on a scale of 1 to 5 pies? What would you give that out of 5?
I would give that 4.1 pies.
4.1 pies out of 5. Meat and potato, standard?
Yeah, meat and potato, decent. And they had a pea option as well, pie and peas option, which is rare, but northern.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, if you're in Guiseley, if you're in and around Leeds, then peas is probably the one thing that you would expect on the side of your pie. And as a result of that victory on Sunday, Guiseley have set up a mouth-watering tie with the bad man of League One, Joey Barton's Fleetwood Town, coming all the way to Yorkshire for that game. And fingers crossed we're going to be there.
And from Nethermoor Park in Guiseley to the Emirates Stadium in London. This is where I was on Thursday night to see our European team we are following this season up close and personal. And we've gone for Sporting Lisbon, who travelled from Portugal to face Arsenal in the Europa League. And it was one of the worst games of football I have ever been to.
Yeah, I mean, goals-wise, I think I probably need to take some of the responsibility for this, given the fact that in the last week I've been to two football matches and seen 14 goals. You were probably always destined to struggle on Thursday, so apologies for that.
Yeah, cheers. It was dreadful. It was a 0-0 ball draw. Sporting looked content to get a point. Arsenal couldn't really get into it with a half-strength side. And horrendous injury, Danny Welbeck knocked the stuffing out of some of those players. But great experience nonetheless. It was a real good opportunity to see Sporting play. Just importantly, to see their fans as well. They took a few thousand. A great voice all game. And they had the standard crowd orchestrators that you see from European clubs, who stand with their back to the pitch, get the fans whipped up into frenzies along with the beat of the drums to create that raucous atmosphere. And on show for Sporting was Nani, who we all obviously know and love as well. I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, I've met Nani. I met him outside Manchester Airport. Yeah, I never told you this.
Yes, you have. Yeah.
I asked him for a photo and he looked thoroughly disgusted. And then he struggled to find his way into a black taxi to clearly take him home. He'd been at Manchester United about 8 years. Clearly didn't know the city at that point. But yeah. Lovely chap.
There was also Freddie Montero, who scored a hatful of goals in the MLS. Jeremy Mathieu, of course, had a spell and won everything at Barcelona, following a few good years at Valencia. Also, Sebastian Quatez, who we've seen in the Premier League for Liverpool and Sunderland. And I would say the less said about that, the better.
Kept a clean sheet though, didn't he?
Yeah, he did keep a clean sheet. I think I might have kept a clean sheet as well, to be fair. And of course, there was big, bad Bas Dost, who came off the bench and scored goals everywhere he's been, and none more so than for Sporting, where he actually averages a goal a game. So really looking forward to seeing more of him this season. But I think we obviously have to answer the question, why have we chose Sporting? First of all, they fulfilled our hunt for a Europa League team. They're in a league that we can watch a fair bit of. And they should be challenging this year alongside their fiercest rivals, Benfica, along with Porto and Braga.
And I think there's a good bit of narrative given what happened there in the summer with the players cancelling their contracts. There's been a lot of unrest with the ownership and the board, and the training ground was actually overrun by some ultras last year, which led to players fearing for their safety. And Wolves, more than most clubs, have benefited from that. Obviously, Rui Patricio went there, and those court wranglings are still going on for those transfer fees. So it's an interesting one to follow, like you say, both on and off the pitch.
Absolutely, and there's now a new owner, new manager, Marcel Kaiser, formerly of Ajax, and a new outlook following a few turbulent seasons, really, and they're hoping to get back into the Champions League, with only two places available in that league, one of which is through qualifying campaigns too. Competition's tight, and it should prove intriguing for the season ahead, and we'll keep you updated as we go along.
We will indeed. And the latest result from Sporting Lisbon was a 2-1 home win over bottom of the league, GD Chavez.
That's already better than Hertha last season, because they were losing to bottom of the league.
They've got more points in one game than Southampton have for the majority of the season, so I might just support them forever, full stop.
Speaking of Southampton, join us after the break to see how we're getting on at the bottom end of the table.
It's a joke!
Maybe it takes me one or two games to adapt, but for me it's not a problem. The one criticism of the French league is it's a little bit boring, you know. I can understand, you know. I watch Lille yesterday. They have 10 men and they're happy to lose 1-0. You know, they have 10 men, and for me you might as well lose 5-0 as 1-0.
And it just dawned on me that obviously my worst nightmare is coming true, and I'm obviously doing this ridiculous French accent.
Welcome back to the third part of this week's Sweeper podcast, and we're going to Cardiff, where they picked up a massive victory, 2-1 at home against Brighton.
They did indeed, and Brighton took the lead very, very early on, and Cardiff showed great character to get back into it. And given Brighton's recent record of 1-0 wins, the last thing they would have wanted was to concede so early from a set piece, let Brighton effectively try and see the game out from there.
I think that you have to give credit to Cardiff, though. We talked early on in the season and we were quite jovial about their chances of surviving relegation, but actually, you look at the last six games, they've picked up a decent amount of points. They're conceding far less goals, and actually they're scoring goals from different sources as well.
Yeah, you're right. You know, it's the type of game that Cardiff have to win to stand a chance of survival. You know, we're good value for the win as well, as we say. And I think a trip to Everton may bring them back down to earth next. The Wolves at home after that is probably one they'll see they can get a chance for points. You know, they troubled them last season in the Championship. It's obviously a slightly different story now. But Cardiff, you know, they're still in the relegation zone, but level on points with Southampton and Palace, and only one behind Burnley and Newcastle. And it's very, very tight down there, but they're giving themselves a chance every single week now.
They are. I think we need to talk about the key incident in this game. Obviously, following Lewis Dunk's header, and the game kind of was devoid of a huge amount of quality at this stage. And then Dale Stevens just flies in with a reckless challenge in the 34th minute. And do you see any other decision that the referee could have made?
No, it was an odd one. He kind of went past the ball at the side rather than necessarily going over, and it was just almost as if he completely mistimed it, as well as getting his body in the wrong position. And yeah, it was a really odd one from someone who's generally, I would say, relatively calm is maybe the right, you know, he's controlled and calm in his manner generally, and you don't expect that from him. And I'm sure he's not done it intentionally and gone in to do it on purpose, but it just, the whole thing just seemed very bizarre. It wasn't as though the ball was nipped away from him at the time. It just, yeah, just a dreadful challenge.
It was, and obviously Cardiff went on to get the victory. Sol Bamba with a goal. About the fifth time of asking when the ball finally hit the back of the net. But the fact that the referee's not butting for taking his shirt off, A, is laughable. The fact the referee asked him if he took his shirt off and he lied, and said, I mean, fair play, you're not going to say yes, are you, and take the booking at that point. But he's massive. Like, how's the referee not seen him take his shirt off?
I genuinely don't know.
He's the size of a small country. Like, he's probably, I reckon he's the biggest man in that football stadium there. There's probably 25,000 people there on Saturday. He's the biggest man. He's within 10 yards of the referee and he still doesn't see it.
And the only one with his top off as well.
Yeah, yeah. It's a strange decision from, I think it was Martin Atkinson who was in charge. And he definitely got away with one. But yeah, Neil Warnock talked very, very passionately about the result, the fans, the players. And Cardiff are going in the right direction. I struggle to really talk in any seriousness about Warnock because he's just that sort of guy, isn't he?
His face when the goal went in.
No.
He licked his lips about 58 times in 4 seconds. He was just so excited. He was like an excitable dog licking his lips and just heading every ball and twitching away. And he loves it, doesn't he? He absolutely loves it. And, you know, he's almost a comedy character for us and probably will be for the rest of the season as well. But he just manages to do something with whatever he's got to be able to scrape through, or, you know, as we saw last year, not even just scrape through, absolutely smash through it.
Absolutely right. We need to move to the northeast when Newcastle picked up another massive 3 points, beating Bournemouth 2-1, and there was one man who got all the headlines in this game.
Yeah, absolutely. Salomon Rondon, who's very much the hero, playing exactly how he should be on the last man, with strength and power. And that second goal was delicious. Great ball in, an emphatic header. One of my favourite types of goals, without a shadow of a doubt. And Newcastle actually played some really good football at times. They just need to add that consistency to the game. And, you know, they show small signs of improvement, but they have to do it over a long period of time. And I think that was what happened last year. You know, they were lucky that they managed to string a few wins together towards the end of the season and completely pull themselves away from it. But as well as Rondon, you've got the likes of Keeson Young, who seems to be fairly influential, and his deliveries along with Matt Ritchie could be key if they can keep Rondon going.
I think that's going to be the problem, isn't it? I think at West Brom, when he was there, a lot of their fans talked about his lack of availability. He often got injured or almost seemed to run out of steam, and that could be the problem if they're going to hang all of their hopes on him. But the formation that Rafa's playing, he wants a big target man in the middle. He wants to play with wingers. He wants to get it out there and get the ball in quickly. I think the ball that Kennedy put in for the second goal, like you say, was a great one. It's a cracking header, and I think it's the sort of goal that really brings the crowd to life. The difficulty from a Newcastle point of view is you look at the first 10 games of the season and they were absolutely dreadful. It's taken them until the 11th game to win, and then they've won 2 games relatively comfortably. I know that Bournemouth sort of came on strong in the second half and they did have chances. And the game against Watford, yes, you would argue that Watford were probably the better side in that. But defensively, Newcastle look all right. They don't look like a terrible team. And that would be the most frustrating part of it. Why can you put two results together when the first 10 you pick up 2 points? And that would be my continuing worry for Newcastle, is if they're capable of going 10 games without a win, then could that happen again, and could they find themselves in trouble when they start playing better sides?
We'll see you next time out, because it's a massive game against Burnley as well, and a win there effectively, you know, does turn the season around. 3 wins in 3, pulling away from the chasing pack and looking up rather than down. And I think crucial for Newcastle, and you saw it at the weekend, was the atmosphere. You know, it's key up there all the time, and if you can get the fans on side from the word go, it's huge for them, and it's quite an intimidating place to go and play football as well. And I think Bournemouth will have struggled with that to a certain extent. You know, they'll be disappointed only to take the consolation goal. They were second best for large parts, and, you know, a huge injury for Adam Smith probably disrupted the flow of the game and potentially the mentality of the players as well.
Yeah, it was so innocuous, wasn't it? He was just lining that free kick up, and then he just went down in so much pain. And it's obviously a bad injury, and we hope from a Bournemouth point of view that he can get back on the pitch as soon as possible.
Absolutely. Well, let's go down to St Mary's, where Southampton drew 1-1 with Watford. And do we start with Charlie Austin, or do we finish with Charlie Austin?
Let's start with Charlie Austin.
Or should we bookend it and start and finish?
Let's start and finish with Charlie Austin, because I think he was the blockbuster attraction for this game. He replaced Danny Ings. Early on in the game, Danny Ings tweaked a hamstring in the warm-up, and Mark Hughes, being the intelligent manager that he is, decided to throw him in from the start. Why wouldn't you? He's probably going to be out for a few weeks now, so thanks for that one, Mark. And Charlie Austin came in, did very, very little in the game.
Scored a lovely goal, though.
Yeah, until the ball was squared across to him from Nathan Redmond in the second half, and he made it 2-0, or so we thought.
Yes. My opinion is that he should have had that. Yoshida was there, and that's all I'll say. He didn't do anything other than just be there.
Yeah.
And... you know, it's one of those things. Unfortunately, it's a very bad decision. It does go against you, but I think there's another decision that has been massively overlooked by certainly Charlie Austin. That's for sure.
Yeah, I've heard quite a few people talk about this. How supposedly Mark Hughes and Charlie Austin should have come out and said, "Well, Watford should have had a penalty as well." When was the last time that you heard any player or manager support a refereeing decision against their team? Yeah. It just doesn't happen. So. I agree with you. Watford should have had a penalty. Ryan Bertrand should have been sent off because he was already on a yellow card. And that would have naturally changed the game as well. But that doesn't take anything away from the fact that the referee had missed that. So he's got that one wrong. The fact that he then gets the Austin goal decision wrong doesn't therefore make it right. I think that you have to be judged individually. And if you're making two high profile errors in a game like that, then... you don't really deserve to be refereeing at that standard. It's a pretty harsh way of looking at it. But Simon Cooper's recently come up from the Championship. There were a lot of fans of Championship clubs on social media over the weekend saying how poor he'd been at their clubs and how they couldn't believe that he was in the Premier League. They thought that he'd actually been relegated from the Championship and was doing League One games now. And I agree with Charlie Austin. I think that Southampton as a club over the last season or so have been punished quite heavily in these situations. You look at what happened at Watford last season where Doucouré handballs it in and that robs us of 3 points. You look at this one again and there's...
Was Burnley away last season? The ref got in the way or something?
That one went for us, yeah. But, I mean, that's I say that one went for...
argument then, isn't it?
But I think with that, that's just... That's not a refereeing mistake. Yeah, that's something where you put yourself there and somebody kicks the ball at you. I agree with Charlie Austin. I think that these referees do need support. I think that VAR is being used in so many different leagues, and I think his point about the Premier League being the best league in the world is a good one. Why wouldn't you use it if it's available to you? I understand that the technology is not probably the finished article yet, and that's what needs work, and hopefully that's going on behind the scenes. But ultimately, take the refereeing decisions out of it, that man did nothing in that game. For 75 minutes that he was on the pitch, he was anonymous, he didn't track back, and wasn't good enough. So there's two sides of the coin, and as much as the referee probably did cost us 2 points, if he'd have tried a little bit harder, the argument would be that Southampton could have been clear a lot earlier on.
So Markey's still there at the minute. 3 wins in 20. Terrible home form. And movement at the top of the club as well in the last week. Where do we see this one going then?
They've sacked Les Reed, who was the director of football at Southampton, and he's done a fantastic job in 60% of the time that he's been there. Under his stewardship, we finished sixth in the Premier League. He's responsible for a lot of very good transfers and some very good transfers going out as well. We've made good money, and you can't really argue with that. The problem is that over recent seasons the club has been rotten, and somebody has to take responsibility for that. You look at the recruitment for the managers, and Les Reed played a big part in that. So to sack him probably sends a message out to Mark Hughes. The issue that we've now got is we've got the chairman in charge, and he will look after the football operations side of things until a replacement's found. So you would imagine that's going to give Mark Hughes a stay of execution, because a chairman wouldn't normally make a decision over who the new manager is going to be. That would normally be down to the board, or it'd be somebody who's got some sort of football knowledge. He is purely there from a business acumen point of view. So I think that the danger of sacking Hughes is we could end up with someone even worse, and I don't know if that's possible at this stage. But it's just a really poor situation from Southampton's point of view. You don't want to be there, and I think the longer it goes on, the more chance there is that we're going to find ourselves relegated. And having watched the full 90 minutes on Saturday, I genuinely think we'll go down. And I know it's quite a big shout early on, but defensively we're frail. We've won one game at home in a year. And with that sort of form, there's only one place that you really deserve to be. I just feel sorry for the paying fans who buy season tickets and have basically paid the best part of £20 per goal over the last 12 months. It's just bonkers.
Well, Watford will take the point and move on, no doubt. It was a gritty performance from them, much improved in the second half, but you could argue they didn't really deserve much more than a draw. Charlie Austin said they deserve nothing.
And that's probably where we should leave that before I lose it even more. Let's move to Yorkshire, where Huddersfield picked up a battling 1-1 draw with West Ham.
And they looked bang up for it after their first win in the season last week. You know, the fans were up for it as well. They smelt blood and an effort off the bar first. Pritchard scores the opener. And they couldn't get any closer when I think it was Billing's cross hits the post and runs across the goal line. And then the second half comes and West Ham probably have the better of it.
Yeah, and my mate Felipe Anderson, flop of the season, scores again.
Felipe Anderson.
I was impressed with him. I thought it was a good finish. Arnautovic's shot was hilarious. The fact that he managed to almost trip himself over. Yeah. And no one wanted to pass to Anderson either, did they? I think three or four players had shots before it broke to him, and he showed them exactly what he had to do, beating four or five men who were placed quite nicely in the six-yard box. So I think, on reflection, a point's probably fair. Huddersfield were the better team in the first half. West Ham were probably the better side in the second half. And Huddersfield could have lifted themselves out of the bottom three if they'd held on to that victory. But I think it's progress, given where they were a couple of weeks ago. We were kind of saying, where's the next goal going to come from? Where's the next point going to come from? They've got 4 points out of the last two home games, and if they can continue to breed a bit of confidence into that side, then they may well be all right.
They can't score more than one, though, and that's possibly going to be the problem. It's going to need a bit of a rout for them to be to lift themselves further, I suspect. But let's go to the last game of the weekend, which was Leicester City 0, Burnley 0. First game back at the King Power following the tragic accident after the last home game. And, you know, it wasn't a classic at all. And you could argue that the result was secondary to the occasion. It was something that they need to get out of the way. You know, massive credit to the club and the fans for the fitting tributes they paid. Burnley fans also played their parts in the tributes too, it must be said. And, you know, Leicester will be drained. And this international break will be much welcomed. This week they've been to Thailand and back, which, you know, doesn't help preparation for anything, does it?
No, and when you look at what's happened since the disaster, to have picked up 4 points from those two games is credit to everyone involved there. I don't think there's a huge amount to cover from the game on the weekend, because it was devoid of quality, it was devoid of chances, and I think Leicester deserve a huge amount of credit for the way that they've handled everything. I agree with you on Burnley as well. The amount of fundraising that they did prior to the game and the tributes that have been led to the people that died have been fitting. So I think that's probably a good place to close.
Absolutely. Well, that is all for the Premier League. Join us after this short break, where we're going to give you a little bit of Kieran trivia. I need somebody, not just
anybody. You know, I need someone. Welcome back to the final part of this week's Sweeper podcast, and it's almost time for the aforementioned Kieran trivia. But Mitch is going to let you know how you can get in contact with us first.
Yes, you can get in touch with us and tell us all about our puns at Twitter at The Sweeper Pod, Instagram and Facebook, search The Sweeper Podcast, and email us at thesweeperpodcast@gmail.com. And whilst we're on it, you can get us on iTunes. Subscribe, rate and review. You can get us on SoundCloud, Deezer, Spotify, Anchor, Audio Boom, Google Podcast, wherever you want to get your podcast from, really. But get listening, get sharing it. Share it to all your friends and Santa will come down your chimney and give you something nice.
And keep your eyes peeled on our social media accounts this week, because we've had a bit of a rebrand, haven't we?
We have. You're going to be seeing a lot more of us, I'm afraid. And we've had a little bit of help from one of our friends as well. And I'm looking forward to it.
Indeed. What's the scores on the doors in the quiz, Mitch?
It's 11-8 to you. I had a bit of a shocker last week, didn't I?
I don't think you had a shocker. I think you just...
I'd quite like to have got all of them right.
Yeah, you flipped your coin and every time it came out the other side, didn't it? But yes. You pretty much narrowed every answer down to two people, so...
So I'm hoping that you don't get a huge amount this week and stretch the gap, but we shall see. And I will start you off in traditional fashion with the blockbuster theme of A is for Argentine. Juan Foyth became the third Argentine score for Spurs. Can you name the other two?
Ever?
Yep. Well, in the Premier League.
Oh, right, okay. Premier League era.
Should have specified that, because there are quite a few, haven't they?
Yeah.
Traditionally as well.
I was going to say. I don't know if he's Argentinian, and I could completely screw this up by going with it. Is Eric Lamela Argentinian?
He is.
Right, so that's one.
That is one.
So there's one more Argentinian to have scored for Tottenham.
In the Premier League.
Can I...
I'll give you a clue. It's not Gazzaniga.
No, who's just been called up to the Argentina national side as well, which is bonkers in itself.
Poch must have sent him some cash in an envelope.
I've got someone in mind. Can you just give me... I'm going to go with this guy regardless.
Just go with it.
Maurizio Tirico.
Correct.
Okay.
Well played.
Thank you very much.
1 point.
That's 1 point.
Yes, it is 1 point. S is for second top scorers. One of my favourite rounds from our quiz nights and one of your least favourite rounds, I suspect.
Yeah.
Who is Newcastle United's second top scorer in the Premier League?
Now then, it's possible that it could be Alan Shearer, because obviously he didn't spend his whole career at Newcastle, did he? He banged some goals in for Blackburn. Les Ferdinand, you've got Andy Cole. So it's purely goals that they've scored for Newcastle.
In the Premier League, yeah.
I'm going to go for Andy Cole.
Is incorrect, I'm afraid. It's Peter Beardsley.
Wow, yep, really?
47 goals, and that's over 100 behind Alan Shearer.
I would have thought Andy Cole scored more than 47.
No, he was just four ahead of Shola Amiobi and Andy Cole, who were joint third with 43 goals.
It's a good stab. I'll take it. It's fine. One out of two is not bad.
So C is for clean sheet. Who is the only other English goalkeeper in the top 10 clean sheets of the Premier League history alongside Joe Hart? Do you want that again?
Yeah.
So in the top 10 clean sheet record history of the Premier League, there's two English goalkeepers. Joe Hart's one. Who's the other?
I don't think David James kept that many clean sheets. David Seaman.
Is incorrect. It's actually Ben Foster.
Wow.
He's currently still trying to work his way up there. He currently sits eighth with 75 clean sheets.
Very, very impressive. I'm surprised Seaman hasn't collected more than that.
No, Seaman conceded a lot of goals, clearly.
Absolutely, yeah.
R is for red cards. Who has had more red cards in the Premier League? Jamie Carragher or Steven Gerrard?
it's just a shootout,
isn't it?
It's a 50-50.
It's a 50-50. It's the weekly 50-50.
Surely it's got to be Jamie Carragher, but you just... you don't know. Gerrard had that streak about him, didn't he? Steven Gerrard.
You bastard. Yes, it is. By long shot as well. He had six and Carragher only had two.
Loved a booking though, didn't he?
Yeah, he did love a booking and an own goal. So that is 2 from 4.
2 on 4.
And A is for Anelka. Can you tell me how many clubs Nicholas Anelka has played for?
Premier League clubs clubs? Premier League clubs. Arsenal, Liverpool, Bolton, Manchester City. He definitely played for more than four. Chelsea. Did he play for somebody else? He's probably played for somebody else as well. I'm going to go for 5.
He's incorrect. It was 6. He did play for someone else. He played for West Brom.
Oh, of course he did. Well, I'll take 2 out of 5.
I'll take 2 out of 5 as well, to be honest.
It's not a bad score. And that leaves it 13-8 overall with Mitch in the hot seat the week after we come back from internationals, because presumably we're doing head-to-head next week.
We are doing head-to-head internationals, and we'll have a little bit of an England feature. We've got plenty to talk about, such as Wayne Rooney's return to the international fold.
Callum Wilson winning his first cap, and 4 goalkeepers selected again.
Yeah, it's almost laughable, really, isn't it? We are a dreadful country with dreadful records in international tournaments, no ambition, no hope, and yeah, international friendly against USA.
Sounds brilliant. Join us next week for that.
Sayonara.